From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the fifth day of May 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of Adium Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois. And later in this half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Matt Blaisdell of the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana. Dave Dickey will be along, too, with the Ag News for the day, and I'll bring you the second of our four-part story of corn series. And then in the second half hour of the program on many of these stations and always online at willag.org, we'll discuss how in 1964, the University of Illinois was instrumental in the foundation of a university in the West African nation of Sierra Leone and a renewed interest in tying the institutions together today. Hey, don't forget, in just 26 minutes, we'll talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. And it all happens on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Leonard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Leonard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Leonard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
In Chicago on this Wednesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby May wheat at $5 and a penny, a penny and a quarter higher. The July harvest month at $5.12, up one and a quarter. July hard red in Kansas City at $5.24, a penny and a half higher on the afternoon. From the corn pit in Chicago, up four and three quarters in the nearby futures, 364 and three quarters for the May contract. July, a 373 settlement price, up 4 cents. September, 380 and three quarters, up three. And December futures, 389 and one quarter, up two and a quarter cents. The March contract, $4.25, up two and three quarters. May soybean futures, $9.68 and a quarter, down eight and three quarters today. July at 978, 9 cents lower. And the August soybeans, 975 and a half, down nine and a quarter. September futures, 961 and a half, eight and a half lower. And November bean futures, 955 and a half, new crop settled, 7.5 cents lower. May bean meal futures at 279.70, down $5.80. July at 282.90, down 4.90. May bean oil, 38.64, up 28. July there at 38.93, up 25. June live cattle futures, 96.70, 67.5 higher. August at 95.25, up 10 cents. May feeders at 113.90, up 47.5. And the August contract at 116.67.5. 7.5 cents higher. May lean hog futures at 89.35, down 67.5. The June at 84.47.5, up $2.27.5. This is the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures June contract, $79.86 a barrel, down $2.88. Ethanol at $1.59 and 3 cents, just about 6 tenths of a cent lower. Natural gas in the June contract up, or rather down, 3 2/10 of a cent at $3.98 and a tenth. And the heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.18, down 7 8/10 of a cent. The gold futures now at $1,174.60 an ounce, up $6, and the gold and the Dow Jones Industrial Average, that is, at 10,826, just about 100 points lower on the afternoon. The Goldman Sachs at 520.7, down 14.97 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast looks like at this hour. Futures are it's calling for a cold front that should trigger scattered thunderstorms this afternoon, a potential for isolated severe thunderstorms in the northern and central parts of Indiana. Rainfall will be less than half an inch in most of those locations. A few spots could pick up heavier amounts, but there's not expected to be any negative impact. A second and stronger frontal boundary will move across Illinois and Indiana late this work week. Precip will be heavier and once again focused more on the northern sections. Isolated flooding may result, especially in northern Indiana. Temperatures, here's where the important part comes, will drop significantly this weekend. Frost and possibly freezing are likely, but damage will be limited due to the early growth stage, of course, of the corn crop. The more active weather pattern will continue next week and bring moderate to locally heavy rainfall to the Ohio River Valley. There will be a threat of some flooding, but mainly confined to the very low-lying areas. We're on the agricultural weather when we get to the bottom of the hour, and we talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's a Wednesday afternoon. Paul Cooley is on the line with us from Oakland, Illinois, and ADM Investor Services to take a look at the agricultural futures markets. Good afternoon to you, Paul.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Kind of another interesting day in this week when we've seen the world economy, at least parts of Europe, stumble pretty harshly, and the marketplace has been reacting to that and, of course, to the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. It's all kind of spilled over into what's been happening in Chicago, too. What did you find in the market today?
Yeah, I think it when I hear the word this euro dollar and Europe, it does basically mean big, bad problems for Europe, and it means deflation, slow growth, reinflation. They got to reinflate their deal, and it seems like when you have eight or nine small countries, so to speak, and they have to work together and there's a lack of cooperation, it is scary. And it did create a pretty major sell-off in the stock market. Yesterday, the markets traded everywhere today. A big sell-off in crude oil and a big rally in the U.S. dollar. I think the one thing that's interesting, we knew the commodity markets were going to open weak today, and there were several people trying to bottom pick options and futures. But we did hear that the word China may be buying, pricing. We did hear in the country a large exporter out raising their basis bids, trying to buy corn. So that was interesting, and particularly with a basically a nice-looking prospect in central Illinois. We go back to the China topic for just a quick moment. If it's private business going on, people think that's a small amount of grain volume the Chinese will buy. If it's a government deal, it'll mean a lot. The second thing is that there is a large supply of Brazilian corn, Argentine corn, of course, U.S. corn available in the marketplace. And I guess the last thing about it is that we do have a fairly large carryover, so it will be a welcome sale if and when it does happen.
Next, let's explore the China impact just a bit more. So a small sale would be what? 4 million bushel, 10 million bushels, a big sale, something between 50 and 100 million bushel.
Well, I was going to say, the anticipated, I think, is 15, 20 million bushels. A big sale would be 2 million tons or 3 million tons or something like that, which would be, 120 million bushels or something.
Right, at 40,000. Yeah, 400. Okay, so the difference is pretty wide. Is the culprit in the background the idea that they didn't raise near the corn crop they did last year and they're just short of corn, and because they've got a corn crop in the ground just like we do, does that relegate this to a short-term fix through, I don't know, the month of August or September?
Well,
or
we know
like
a couple of things, that the Chinese are probably better managers of inventory than I think our government is, even in the fact they have 40 million tons of corn in their grain bank, so to speak, and in their reserves, and they've been selling this out,
right.
And they've been selling out a million tons. The real culprit is the price of corn is so high that it justifies buying corn from the U.S. and putting it in their marketplace. And we do know they have a fairly large inventory of hogs and poultry and things like that. I think the big factor is it's profitable for them to buy corn. Some of their private industry, maybe with a wink from the central government, is doing so. The culprit, of course, as you said, there is a debate about what the real size of their corn crop was last year. That's going to be debated, and it's going to be several months before we know. some of the shrewd traders we talk about feel that the big purchase won't take place until July, August time frame here in the U.S. Let's face it, they're buying some awful cheap corn at some, and we have a big inventory of corn in the world for them to buy.
Yeah, does it mean because they operate pretty much on the same season that we do, they've got a corn crop that's going in the ground now, mm-hmm. and will harvest this fall, that really it's a short-term gain for the marketplace, or are they just pulling enough corn out of the market? I suppose it depends mostly on how much they pull out, that it could really have an impact on the ending stocks in the United States, and that we won't know for quite a while.
I think we won't know for quite a while, and some of that buying that was done last week we thought would show up in export sales, and it just hasn't showed up yet. So that's part of guessing game in the corn market. The other factor is maybe the government with this China business will raise exports up to 1925, but we still have a big inventory, and there's a general feeling of the central Illinois farmer maybe planted a little more corn. It was planted early under new hybrid genetics, so that's all good news for the corn crop 2010.
Right. So I guess then you have to come back to the bottom line. Does all of this change the way you think about the corn market, old and new crop?
Well, we're always, Drew Lerner put out a bed sheet this morning, a market outlook as far as weather. People are wondering when there will be some dryness show up, and of course he's now saying probably pretty late in the growing season. Another meteorologist that I talked to says it's a green light for production here for 30 days. So this European problem, this devaluation of Europe, also a major problem with the CFTC announcing. There's even the derivatives legislation going on in the marketplace. And we are seeing fairly good inventory selling by farmers because, what more would you want other than this growing conditions as of today look perfect in the Illinois cornfields.
All right. Anything else to add before I let you go?
Have a profitable day, Todd.
You too, Paul. Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report. That happens each and every Wednesday afternoon.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Now, if you'd like to hear Paul again, you can always do that in a couple of ways. You can sign up for the podcast or you can listen to him directly from the website. Both are available at willag.org, or you can dial this number, 217-333-3434. It's willag.org or 333-3434. Dave Dickey is here now. He'll help us go through all the agricultural news for the afternoon.
In agricultural news, Japanese and U.S. officials will meet soon, perhaps as early as this month, for the first in a series of planned sessions to discuss improving beef trade between the two countries. USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack says the two countries are now in the process of designating officials to staff the meeting and choosing the location and specific dates, either in May or June. USDA Undersecretary Jim Miller says the primary goal is to get Japan to completely open its market to U.S. beef, regardless of how old the cattle were at slaughter. Louisiana Gulf ports, which handle the bulk of U.S. agricultural commodities, will remain open through at least Thursday as the BP oil spill again appears to be positioned away from the main shipping channel used to access the ports. Port operators have been assessing their operating situation daily since the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded and sank last week, spilling thousands of barrels of crude oil into the Gulf. So far, shipping and port operations have not been affected by the oil slick, but the threat looms until the oil slick is contained. In a farm bill hearing in California, House Agriculture Committee Chairman Colin Peterson said that the U.S. sugar program is working exactly as it is supposed to, and that he does not foresee big changes in the program in the next farm bill. Speaking of testimony on other parts of the farm bill and hearings in Iowa, Idaho, and California, Peterson said that he experienced few surprises so far, except that, quote, I was led to believe dairy was more united than they actually are. The Environmental Committee of the European Parliament voted yesterday to exclude from the European Union market food obtained from cloned animals because of health and safety concerns. The lawmakers rejected a proposal by the European Commission and backed by member states to include food produced from cloned animals in a list of approved foodstuffs marketed and consumed in the bloc. A final parliamentary vote is scheduled for July. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of this show, The Farming World, that comes up in the second half hour of the program today, and of Commodity Week. You can hear them all online anytime you'd like at willag.org. Now, up next, the second in our series we call The Story of Corn. Today, how open-pollinated corn was adapted to the Midwest. In the 1840s, there were about 250 varieties of corn. They originated in Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky. As farmers in these states began their movement north and westward into Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa, they brought those crosses with them. 40 years later, in the 1880s, these producers had adapted the 250 varieties to the local conditions in the states across the Midwest. It resulted in 1,000 locally adapted open-pollinated varieties of corn. In 1888, Iowa, for the first time ever, raised more corn than any other state in the Union. The extra 750 varieties of open-pollinated corn, says retired corn breeder Forrest Troyer, were more drought-tolerant and shorter-seasoned than the original 250.
Out of those 1,000 varieties, I don't know the exact number, but there were probably 20 or 30 varieties that were grown much more than the others. One thing that contributed to that was the corn shows.
One of the most popular varieties was called Limming. It was developed about 40 or 50 miles northeast of Cincinnati, Ohio, in Wilmington, and had won a corn show in Paris, France. It was the first widely adapted variety of yellow corn. Half of all the yellow corn grown in the U.S. was at one time Limming corn. It actually represented just one quarter of the total U.S. corn crop, because 50% of the corn grown in the mid-1800s was white dent corn, not yellow dent corn. Well, the next big variety was to become the foundation of almost all of today's hybrid corn. It was called Reed's Yellow Dent. Troyer says Robert Reed developed the variety by accident when he moved from Russellville, Ohio to Delavan, Illinois. In that first year, he planted and saved back seed from a variety called Gordon Hopkins corn. It had been planted late in the season. The following spring, he planted the Gordon Hopkins corn again.
He didn't run a germination test, and he got a field of corn where the stand was too good to tear up, but it wasn't as good as it should be. So he went in and he hand-planted what they called a common early yellow flint that was grown in the area. And because the early corn was planted later, they crossed. And then over a period of at least 40 years, Robert Reed and then later James Reed selected reeds yellow dent.
It became very popular after winning the corn show at the Chicago Columbian Exposition. Troyer says because of the win, farmers oftentimes called reed yellow dent World's Fair corn. A Perry Holden, head of the agronomy department at the University of Illinois, evangelized reed yellow dent, and he convinced the Funk brothers of Bloomington, Illinois, to start producing and selling reed yellow dent. Holden later took a position at Iowa State University and took 600 bushels of reed yellow dent with him. Troyer says some Iowa seedsmen were not very happy about the introduction of an Illinois corn in their state.
It soon replaced a lot of the varieties that were formerly in Iowa.
Reed yellow dent and livestock feeding trial studies from the University of Wisconsin and Purdue are the major reasons U.S. corn farmers abandoned white corn. By the way, most of the 1,000 original pollinated varieties developed and grown in the Midwest were white corn. The university studies proved pigs grew faster when they ate yellow corn. It was because yellow corn provided a good source of vitamin A, and white corn did not. This one attribute, vitamin A, eliminated the majority of the genetic material farmers and corn breeders would work with to develop hybrid corn in the 1920s and 30s. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You are listening to the Closing Market Report. This is a production of Illinois Public Media. On the line with us to take a look at the cash grain market this afternoon, Aaron Anderson of the Andersons. He's located at their Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Aaron. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
And farmers out of the field or in the field there today?
Pretty much out of the field. Everyone's fairly well planted around here. I would say we're pretty much done with corn and beans in our area.
And I suppose the spray rigs haven't been able to go because, well, it's been awful windy.
Yeah.
So does that mean they've been busy trying to market some grain?
They have. We've seen heavier truck lines here in the last 4 to 7 days than we've seen in quite a while.
And are they selling? They're selling out of their bin, I suppose. Is it coming in pretty good condition?
Yeah, for the most part, same type of condition we've been seeing. A little bit more damage, but not, you know, a big change. And the vomitoxin issue hasn't seemed to have gotten any worse here yet.
And anybody hauling soybean in?
Not of any quantity, really.
I didn't think there were any left, but I thought maybe. Well, what do you think of basis at this time?
Pretty steady. I don't see it falling apart here anytime soon. I think we're going to be steady going into June.
And what are your bids on the day?
Right now, Climbers is at 365 for May, and Delphi is at 357 for May corn.
When you talk to the folks around the Midwest and throughout the nation, what do they say at this point about two things? The floods on the Ohio River and the lower Mississippi there, and then about what's been happening in the Gulf of Mexico and the impact it might have.
It is having a little bit of an impact from what we understand. Obviously, crude oil has been fairly volatile here the last week, so it is having a bit of an impact on our futures market. The flooding, I don't think that's a real big issue. At least it doesn't seem to be at the moment on the board. You know, with the majority of the corn crop being in Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana, I don't know that the Tennessee and Kentucky issue is showing its head that big on the board at the moment.
Okay, thanks so much, Aaron. Aaron Anderson is with the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana. Back in 2 minutes when we'll talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming Dave Dickey. In business news, Mortgage Bankers Association data today shows that demand for loans to buy U.S. homes raced to a 7-month high last week in the final hurrah for federal home buyer tax credits that ended April 30th. Home purchase loan applications jumped 13% to the highest level since early October. It was the third straight weekly increase in purchase applications. Eligible borrowers seeking to take advantage of federal tax credits of $8,000 for first-time buyers and $6,500 for existing homeowners were required to sign contracts by last Friday and must close on their loans by June 30th. Seed engineering company Monsanto today says that its 2010 profit per share will be at the low end of its forecast range of $3.10 to $3.30. Analysts had estimated 2010 earnings for Monsanto at a per share rate of $3.16. A report from Challenger, Gray, and Christmas today suggests the number of planned layoffs at U.S. firms fell more than 40% in April to the lowest level in nearly 4 years. Employers announced just over 38,000 planned job cuts last month, the lowest since July of 2006. The sharp decline in job cut announcements comes just days ahead of the much-anticipated monthly U.S. payrolls report, which is due out on Friday. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media on this Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City joins us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Good afternoon to you, Drew.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Tell me about the forecast for right here in the Midwest.
Well, we're a little concerned about those temperatures coming up here for this weekend. There's not a lot of precipitation in the pipeline for the next few days, but there'll be a few spits and spats going across the northern tier of states here for the next 24 hours or so, and a bigger storm system may slip across the region here. Most likely it'll be on Thursday into Friday. It'll produce rain across most of the Great Lakes region, a little shower activity in the lower parts of the Midwest. But the big issue is the likelihood of colder air coming in behind this precipitation event, which looks like on Saturday and Sunday mornings we're going to see frost and some freezes occurring across the Midwest. Right now it looks like that 32-degree line on Saturday morning is probably going to move or curve through the southwest part of Minnesota into western Iowa and into northeastern parts of Kansas. That occurs on Saturday morning, and it's Sunday morning that most of the eastern Midwest is going to be impacted by freezes and frost. Right now, let's say the freeze line will run from maybe Erie, Pennsylvania, through central portions of Ohio, so around the Columbus area, you know, back into Indianapolis, and then curving back in through the Davenport, Iowa area, and then back up towards the Grand Forks, North Dakota area. Everything north of that line will likely see at least a little bit of a freeze on Sunday morning. Frost will be possible further to the south, reaching all the way down close to the Ohio River. As far as the damage potential is concerned for some of our wheat crop and some of the early emerged corn, most of the corn's growing point, of course, is going to be below the surface of the soil at that point. It probably will not be permanently damaged, but we will burn some leaf mass. And the same kind of thing will occur for wheat, although some of this wheat is getting to the point where we can't go too far below freezing without raising some concern. And I think more of that concern is probably going to be out in northern Kansas on Saturday morning, more so than it will be in the soft wheat areas of the Midwest. And northern Kansas will probably see some temperatures down to 29, maybe a 28-degree reading out there somewhere. And then most of Nebraska will certainly be in the 20s. So you could see some of that early booting crop in Kansas possibly getting nipped a little bit. I do not think there's going to be widespread serious damage, but obviously some superficial injury will occur to these crops, at least over these two mornings.
Where does the cold weather emanate from, and will it come back for a second shot at any point?
Well, it is coming from Canada, and it is very cold across the prairie right now, the Canadian prairie and the northern U.S. plains, and that's going to be a persistent ongoing thing for the next few days. But I think this is a one-time shot for us across the Midwest and the plains. Once this is done with, by the end of the weekend, we should be pretty much done with the frost freeze threats, I believe, for the rest of this production spring season, I guess. There would be a chance for some other cool weather in the northern plains and the upper parts of the Midwest, but we won't see it this far south again, I don't believe, for this season.
All right. Anything else to add before I let you go for the afternoon?
There is going to be a big storm system coming on the back side of the cold air. So when the warmer air starts to come back northward, we're going to see a significant amount of rain occur from parts of the northern plain through the western and northern portions of the Midwest, and that's going to lock us out of the fields for a little while.
Drew, thanks so much.
Have a great day.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City, Missouri. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report that happens each and every Wednesday afternoon. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you, please do stay tuned for The Farming World. Both programs, of course, are a production of Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is The Farming World, news and interviews from the land-grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Paul McNamara from the College of ACES here on the Urbana-Champaign campus. He's an ag economist. And Dr. Abu Sese is with us. He's the vice chancellor of Injala University and located, usually, that is, in Sierra Leone, which is a West African nation. Thank you both so much for joining us live in studio this afternoon.
Great to be here with you today, Todd.
Thank you, Todd.
It's very good to have both of you here. Dr. Sese, why don't you tell me first why it is that you're here and what the connection between the University of Illinois and Injala might be?
Well, Todd, I'm actually here primarily out of consideration of the role this university played in the establishment of JALA in Sierra Leone. JALA University College then, was established by this university in partnership with USAID. You know, after independence, the British officials in agriculture and education returned back to the UK. And a commission was set that requested the American government to make an assessment of our educational needs. And the report of that committee was the recommendation for the establishment of a College of Agriculture and Education. And funds were obtained from USAID, and the University of Illinois was contracted to establish this college.
So this was in 1964.
1964.
Independence had just been established in Sierra Leone.
Exactly.
And the decision was made that they needed to have educational role.
A center of training in agriculture and education.
Yeah, for higher education.
Yeah.
USAID was involved, and the University of Illinois was contracted. Cool. You were a student at that time.
Well, I was in the second class of intake of students. Yes.
Well, what has happened in the intervening time? There's been war. There's been much that's taken place.
Well, yes. The college was established and actually, to a very large extent, fulfilled its mission until this war came about. And the campus was actually attacked repeatedly. So the college had to be relocated in Freetown.
Right, so it was in Injala, in Bo.
It was Injala, not Bo yet, just Jala then.
Injala, and then it was moved to
Freetown.
Freetown.
Yes.
This was in the mid-1990s?
Yes, 1994, 1995, yeah.
Right. And were you on campus at that point?
Yes, I was on campus.
That must have been a very scary thing.
And I was lucky, you know. I left campus to attend a congregation and a Senate meeting in Freetown. And fortunately, my wife convinced me to stay on. That was in December 2004. My wife convinced me to stay on for Christmas. And that was how we escaped. And we had planned to be back to Jala before New Year's. And the morning we were to depart Freetown, the vice chancellor called me and said, "Oh, thank God you're in Freetown. Don't move. The campus had been attacked."
Campus. So they moved to Freetown. In the intervening space between the inception in 64 and then in 94 when the attack came, how did the development of the campus, the agricultural programs that the University of Illinois helped to establish, I assume, and build? Because usually when the university is involved in establishment, it's normally not bricks and mortar. It's it's programming content and
yes.
Science and research and education.
Yes.
How did that all take place?
Well, the college was established in a temporary site there, actually. The Jala The Jala had a lot of long history of training. It started way back in the 18th century when it was a training college for low-powered, low-level agriculture workers. Then it developed to become a permanent school teachers training college. So there are some rudimentary structures or infrastructure that were immediately used, in addition to some temporary, you know, buildings that were put up hurriedly. You know, in fact, we have some pictures showing the professors from Illinois controlling and directing the erection of these temporary structures. As I came to understand it, I think that was some agreement. The Illinois or the USAID agreed to train the staff members and provide lab equipment and other things. And the Ceylon government was to actually put up the permanent structures. That did not materialize, so we continued in the temporary structures. And the strength the college had then was the very highly trained manpower. That was the strength we had before the war. So the curriculum and the training proceeded efficiently. Those of us who were graduates of that institution, some of us were employed and retained to be developed, trained to become staff members, and were sent all over the world, various universities, England, US, Canada, Australia, for further training. And we excelled and went back home.
I took time to take a look at this West African nation because I have not been there. Mm-hmm. So I did the tour via Google Maps, of course, and satellite. There are an awful lot of trees, it appears to me. And I'm wondering what kind of agriculture there is in Sierra Leone.
Well, there's a range. You know, I mean, rice is our staple food. So there's a lot of rice production. And there's palm kernel production, coffee, cocoa, various other tropical food crops, potato, cassava, or tapioca, as some will know it. So it's basically an agricultural nation.
And if I remember correctly, rice is one of the staple expertise areas, is that right?
But at some point, we were even exporting rice. Yes. Oh. Believe it or not, at some point, Sierra Leone was producing enough and to export. Things changed, and we became a rice importing nation.
Mr. McNamara, you have the pleasure and honor, I suppose, of making sure that Dr. Cisse makes it away his way around the University of Illinois campus at this point. Where have you been, and what kind of discussions do you have, and with who on this campus, and what about?
Well, several years ago, some U of I alum, you know, from that original Illinois project, there were a number of Sierra Leoneans who received their master's and PhD degrees here at Illinois. And since the end of the conflict in Sierra Leone, they've been encouraging Illinois to get reengaged in Sierra Leone with N'Djala. And so several years ago, we had some discussions, but it really didn't take hold. But about 2 years ago, we started in earnest to work with them. So we're working on some activities together with N'Djala. We have been for about a year and a half, writing grant proposals, delivering some programs together, education programs for our students and for their students, research projects together, those kinds of things. And the time was right to bring Dr. Cisse here to help him. He's new in his position. He returned to Sierra Leone, recruited by the president and the minister of education to become vice chancellor this past December. So he's new in his position. He had been working out of the country at another university in Africa for a while, and he's back. And we wanted him to get a fresh appreciation of what's going on here at Illinois and what some different potential resources here in terms of faculty with interest, students, research programs, and other resources here at Illinois that we might be able to incorporate in some of our proposed projects together. And so that's why Dr. Cisse is here. He's here to meet people and to make connections and also to present N'Djala to people here as a place where people might be able to do research, might be able to do service, might be able to do education together with our partners there.
Many of our listeners probably at this point are wondering what role higher education or the University of Illinois can play in in Sierra Leone and the development of agriculture there. And I suppose both of you have some ideas on that. Dr. Cisse, why don't you take that question on first?
Well, this is interesting. Yeah, with the emergence of the knowledge economy, there has been a revolution in the thinking about higher education in the developing world. Until quite relatively recently, the thinking was that higher education institutions are just prestige projects in the developing countries, especially Africa. But quite recently, there has been a change. And now higher education institutions are considered as playing a very significant economic and social role, benefit, not only for the individuals, but also for the collective advancement of the nations. And with respect to agriculture, the development of technology is a key area in agricultural development. And JALA was established as the major center for agricultural training and research. And so it has a key role to play in developing the knowledge, in developing the skills, the trained manpower for the advancement of agriculture in the country. As of now, the government has just come up with its strategy for poverty reduction and the transformation of the economy. And the cornerstone of that agenda for change, as the president calls it, is increased agricultural productivity. So as the major institution for agricultural training and research, you see the key role that JALA can play. In fact, we are being called upon to be the major drivers of that aspect of the agenda for change, the agricultural productivity.
Well, Todd, I think, first off, that's a great question about what is the role of higher education in agricultural development in a place like Sierra Leone or sub-Saharan Africa. And Dr. Cisse's pointed out a couple dimensions. I think it's important for people just to understand how critical this translational ability within a country like Sierra Leone is, the ability to take outside ideas, technologies, concepts, and adapt them to employ them in that local context. And when you think about agriculture, you might have a seed variety that works well in Nigeria or Cote d'Ivoire for rice, but it may need further fine-tuning and adaption for the Sierra Leonean context. And you can think about that problem multiplied 100 times into different agricultural niches and processing and other areas. You need trained people who are trained in agricultural science in different fields who can do this kind of work. And also, if you're going to engage in global agriculture and be an exporter or import any significant technologies, you need to be conversant and knowledgeable in those technologies. So that's an important way. But also, I think it's important to realize education institutions impart an ethos and a culture and a way of thinking that's beyond the purely technical, and they play a very important role in forming, training a certain cadre of people in the economy, and that role is critical too. And lastly, there's a role for higher education partnerships between, say, a U.S. university or a European university and a university like NJALA. And that's one that we seek to fulfill.
This afternoon, you're listening, of course, to The Farming World. In studio with us, Dr. Abu Cisse. He's the Vice Chancellor of NJALA University at Sierra Leone. And Paul McNamara, an ag economist here at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about the cooperative efforts that may be developing between these two universities. When we return, we'll discuss some of the challenges that Sierra Leone has and how the university can meet them.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
It's National Hoagie Day. The hoagie was originally created in Philadelphia on Hog Island, home to a shipyard during World War I. Italian immigrants working there would bring giant sandwiches made with cold cuts, spices, oil, lettuce, tomatoes, onions, and peppers for their lunches. By the way, depending where you live, the hoagie goes by lots of names, including the submarine, hero, grinder, dogwood, zeppelin, and poor boy. On this day in agricultural history in 1865, Nellie Bly was born. In 1889, Bly successfully completed an attempt to beat the record of Jules Verne's fictional Phileas Fogg to go around the world in 80 days. Bly was a U.S. newspaper reporter and completed the journey in 72 days, 6 hours, 11 minutes, and 14 seconds. Later in life, she took over her husband's dyeing industries and introduced the steel barrel to the distilling process in America. In 1936, a patent was granted for the first bottle with a screw cap to Edward Ravenscroft of Glencoe, Illinois. In 1904, USDA announced it was considering banning importation of horses from France after an investigation determined that a disease outbreak in Iowa was traced to French horse imports. And in 2006, the Agricultural Research Services announced the development of two new machines to improve cotton lint cleaning. The new machines increased bale weight by 8 to 10 pounds by retaining more good fiber than standard lint cleaners. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, live in studio this afternoon with the Vice Chancellor of Injala University. His name is Dr. Abu Cisse. He's from Sierra Leone, which is a West African country. And his guide to the University of Illinois on this week, Paul McNamara, one of many, I suppose, who's an ag economist from the University of Illinois. Dr. Cisse, we had not taken up some of the recent history of Injala University. The university suffered, of course, during the war. And then in 2005, your nation reestablished the Injala University and a couple of others, I suppose, in your nation.
Yes.
And how did that happen, and what is the mission of Injala today?
Up to the time of the war, up to the time it was attacked, Injala was actually just a component college of the University of Sierra Leone. And in 2005, the government enacted the Universities Act of 2005, which restructured the university, the old University of Sierra Leone, into Jala University and the new University of Sierra Leone. So Jala has grown from being a college to becoming a university now. And now it is no longer just the main major center of training for agriculture and education. It is the center for environmental sciences, technology, forestry and horticulture, social sciences, community health. So it has expanded. It has grown. The baby that was left by this university has grown to become a university and has expanded in terms of its programs, in terms of its enrollment. And you talk about the vision. And people have always asked me about the vision of the university. The vision I have, actually, for Jala is that Jala should become an outstanding center of learning and scholarship with a national and international profile, defined by the high quality of its programs and the quality of and strategic focus of its teaching and research. It should be producing good people, people with skills and substance, people that will be productive in a changing society, and people that will serve the nation and move this nation forward.
And how do you see the cooperative effort with the University of Illinois, if one should develop, coming about? And what kinds of things would you look to the university and its staff and professionals to help provide?
Well, we have a number of strategic objectives that we identified. One of them is the establishment of international partnerships. You see, we think and believe that the future of this university depends on our capacity to plug into the global community of learning. And we put a lot of premium on the establishment of international partnership, because it's through those partnerships that we believe we can realize our mission and strategic objectives. And if we're going to do that, we think the place to start is here, a place with historical ties. And we expect that this relationship, if it becomes reestablished again and energized and strengthened, it will give us that cutting edge in competing for research funds, in competing for development funds, in our training need for our staff. And it's the way to go, we think.
Mr. McNamara, obviously when the NJALA was established in 64, USAID was the driving force. U.S. government at that point thought there must be a reason to be involved. Is there a reason that the taxpayers of Illinois, that the University of Illinois, should be involved in this university today?
I think the way I think about that is, what's the role for higher education in our foreign aid budget? And so that's one part of it. And the way I would answer that is, this is a strategic sector. It's also something that the United States is good at. We're a world leader in higher education, not just agriculture, but engineering and a lot of other fields. So we have something truly to offer people, but it's also strategic to offer that, but in sectors like agriculture, in places like Sierra Leone. These are areas that get attention from the U.S. government for a number of reasons. One being, in a neighboring country, we had U.S. troops in Liberia, and that's a concern. So preventing conflict through economic development, livelihood promotion, and these are arenas where agriculture comes in, is a U.S. interest.
Just a minute or so left. Where do you think there might be interest from this campus, and in what sectors that are broader than agriculture?
Well, we have a lot of things we're active in internationally that might be relevant to NJALA and to Sierra Leone. A couple come to mind. In the business area, we have professors working around the world, working with universities and groups where their teaching and research could be useful. In engineering, in areas like water and sanitation, things that could be useful partnering with NJALA faculty on. Education is another area. There are a host of areas, math and science training, other areas. There are a lot we have to offer, and we would benefit from the partnership, too.
Thank you so very much, Mr. McNamara, Paul McNamara, ag economist at the University of Illinois, and Dr. Abu Cisse, the vice chancellor of NJALA University in Sierra Leone, for joining us here on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, and thank you for listening this afternoon. We'll be back again tomorrow with our programs.